Welcome to the deep dive. This is where we take source material, you send us something fascinating, and really dig into it to pull out the key insights.
And today we're looking at a really compelling interview from YouTube. It's episode 44, Vietnam War veteran George Merritt, 62nd Air Commando on cheating death. That's from the Military Tales channel.
Yeah, it's quite the story. George Merritt shares so much about his time in Vietnam.
He really does. It covers, you know, his initial deployment, the plane he flew, which was a surprise, right through to reflecting on the war years later.
Exactly. So our goal here is to kind of unpack the key moments from his account, see what they tell us about his personal experience, and maybe get a clearer picture of that conflict through his perspective.
Sounds good. Where should we start?
Well, let's begin where he does his background before Vietnam. He was actually a test pilot.
Right, at Edwards Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Flying Mach 2 fighters, the really cutting edge stuff at the time.
Which makes his next assignment, well, quite a contrast.
A huge contrast. He gets assigned to fly the A-1 Skyraider, a propeller plane.
Yeah, he calls it a downer. You can imagine going from Mach 2 jets to a prop plane that goes about 160 knots.
It's not just the speed, it's the whole technological step back, I suppose.
Mm.
And it wasn't like he asked for it either.
No, he mentions he wasn't a volunteer. He was married, had two young sons. So this deployment was duty, not choice.
That definitely adds another layer, doesn't it? Knowing he had a family back home.
For sure. And then he describes arriving in Vietnam on a C-130. What stood out to you there?
The imagery. He talks about the rain, constant rain, and this pervasive red soil everywhere.
Right. And he immediately links that red soil to blood.
Yeah. A really visceral, kind of grim first impression of the place. He called it a bloody country.
That really sticks with you. So his first base was Udorn in Thailand.
Udorn Royal Thai Air Force Base. Yeah. He paints it as relatively established.
How so?
Well, concrete runway. It was near a town, so you could get off base, find some familiar things. He even mentions having to fly 5 initial strike missions there with an instructor.
Okay, sort of like an orientation phase, getting used to the environment and the aircraft in combat.
Exactly. A bit of acclimatization before things got, well, more serious.
Because then they moved to Nakhon Phanom, or NKP, and he says that was a stark difference.
Oh, completely different. NKP was much closer to the Ho Chi Minh Trail, much closer to the fighting.
And the base itself reflected that.
Definitely. The runway was steel planking, not concrete. Off-base access was really restricted, like a 10 p.m. curfew, fewer amenities.
He even saw a body floating in the Mekong River nearby.
Yeah, a constant reminder of the war next door. He describes it feeling like a prison.
He has that aerial photo he took where he says it looks just like a California prison from the air.
It really highlights that sense of confinement, the tension. And importantly, NKP was where the Jolly Green Giant helicopter squadron was based.
Ah, the search and rescue helicopters.
Right, CR, or Combat Search and Rescue. That proximity becomes really central to his story later on.
Okay, so he's at NKP, this more intense base. Let's talk about his first actual combat mission experiences in the Skyraider. What were the challenges?
Well, first off, the terrain. He describes these rolling hills, karst formations, those limestone peaks and dense jungle, makes finding a specific target incredibly difficult.
I can imagine just spotting something small on the ground from the air and all that green.
And remember, he's a wingman initially, so there's pressure to keep up, follow the lead, do the job right.
He tells that story about focusing so hard on the target during multiple passes
that he completely lost his bearings.
Yeah.
Didn't know which way was home when they finished the attack.
That really speaks to the intensity, doesn't it? How focused you have to be.
Absolutely. But then he also mentions that after 188 missions, he knew the area so well, he could recognize a specific spot on a CBS News report years later.
Incredible. That shows just how much time he spent over that landscape. Okay, let's move to what feels like the core of his interview, that first major search and rescue mission.
Right. CSR, Combat Search and Rescue. He'd moved from being a strike wingman to a SAR wingman. Sandy 8 was his call sign for this.
So a different role, protecting the rescue helicopters, coordinating things.
Yeah, providing cover, finding the downed pilot, coordinating with the choppers. This mission was to rescue a Navy A-7 pilot, Kenny Fields, who'd gone down near Chapon. Very dangerous area.
And things escalated quickly.
Very quickly. Sandy 1, another A-1, gets hit and has to leave. Then his own lead, Sandy 7, flown by Ed Leonard, also gets shot down.
Wow. Just like that. So suddenly Merritt, Sandy 8,
is the only Sandy left. He's got 2 downed pilots on the ground, his lead Ed Leonard, and the original target, Kenny Fields, plus the incoming rescue helicopters to manage.
And he'd never actually run a rescue before.
Never led one, no. He said he felt like a deer in the headlights, just suddenly thrust into this immense responsibility.
And it was getting dark, right? They usually didn't do rescues at night.
Correct. Ed Leonard managed to radio that he was okay after parachuting, but they called off the attempt for the night. Too risky. They'd already lost one plane and had another damaged.
So, day two, what happened then?
Day two starts with bad weather. And the area had been heavily bombed by jets overnight and in the morning before they even got there.
Okay, so a chaotic scene. And Kenny Fields, the Navy pilot.
He's reporting enemy forces closing in on him. Very tense situation on the ground.
And then, unbelievably,
Merritt's new lead aircraft gets hit. The pilot has to eject.
No way, another one.
Yes. Merritt watches him eject, sees the A-1 crash. Then he has to guide the Jolly Green helicopter in to pick up that pilot.
Just compounding crises. And the rescue itself wasn't straightforward either.
No, the ejected pilot landed awkwardly in a dead tree, and the downdraft from the rescue helicopter actually knocked him unconscious.
Good grief. This one mission is just packed with drama.
The whole effort over 3 days involved 189 sorties. They lost 7 aircraft. It was a major, major operation.
And on that second day, Merritt, who started as a wingman, ended up leading the Jolly Greens back home.
Yeah, incredible adaptability under fire. Real leadership emerging from necessity.
So we get to day three. You'd think maybe they'd send a fresh crew.
Apparently not. He was told, basically, you've been there 2 days, you know the situation, you're going back.
Wow. Back into that meat grinder. What was the situation for Kenny Fields by then?
Pretty desperate. His radio battery was dying. And tragically, he'd been injured by friendly fire shrapnel from a cluster bomb dropped earlier.
Oh, man. So he's injured, running out of communication, enemy nearby.
His calls for rescue were getting frantic. Then this helicopter pilot, call sign Tom, Dave Richardson, makes an incredibly brave move.
What did he do?
Flew in, hovered under fire, and managed to pluck Kenny Fields out. Richardson apparently felt some kind of divine protection during that hover.
Amazing courage. And they got him out.
They did. Flew him straight to the hospital at NKP.
What an ordeal. And the connections formed during that.
They were profound. The squadron commander visited Kenny in the hospital. Kenny was so grateful, he initially wanted to name his expected child Sandy after the rescuer's call sign.
Did he?
They ended up naming him Todd. But the connection, especially between George Merritt and Kenny Fields, lasted a lifetime.
Really? They stayed in touch?
For over 50 years. They even gave talks together about the rescue. It's an amazing story of friendship born from that shared trauma.
That's incredible. It also highlights the wider impact, doesn't it?
Absolutely. He mentions the immense stress Kenny's wife went through during those 3 days and how it actually impacted their son Todd's health long term. The ripples of war.
Yeah, they spread far. They eventually met again years later.
At a flying safety conference, yeah.
Yeah.
Just amazing how these connections endure.
Now, what about Ed Leonard, Merritt's first lead, the one shot down on day one? What happened to him?
His story is just as intense. He survived the shoot down, managed to cross a road, even got into a brief gunfight that Kenny Fields actually heard from his hiding spot.
So he was mobile initially.
Yes, but then he had to hide. He spent 3 days hiding in a tree while enemy soldiers were searching right below him.
3 days in a tree just above the enemy.
Unbelievable, isn't it? The tension must have been unbearable.
Yeah, no.
He was captured. Became a prisoner of war for 5 years.
5 years? Wow. How did he cope with that?
Remarkably well, it seems.
Yeah.
Merritt talks about Ed's mindset. He used the time for self-reflection, decided he wanted to become a better person. Incredible resilience.
That's truly inspiring. Did he make it back?
He did. After the war, he rebuilt his life, became a lawyer, reconnected with and married an old flame, Suzanne. Merritt visited them later on.
A story of survival and transformation, really.
Definitely. Ed Leonard has passed away since, and Merritt actually spoke at his memorial. But that POW experience, turning it into something positive, that's powerful.
It really is. And this whole shared experience, this massive rescue effort, it led to something more formal, didn't it?
Yes, the Society of Combat Search and Rescue. It sort of grew out of the debriefing for this specific rescue. This is a streetcar 304 mission.
Ed and Kenny were there for that debrief.
They were. And the active duty helicopter pilots realized how valuable hearing these firsthand accounts was.
So they started doing regular sessions.
Yeah. Annual debriefings at military bases.
Yeah.
Sharing the lessons learned from guys like Merritt, Fields, and Leonard with the current generation of rescue crews. Keeping that knowledge alive.
That makes a lot of sense. What about Merritt after the military? Did he stay in aviation?
Oh, yes. He went back to being a test pilot this time for Hughes Aircraft.
Right, Hughes Aircraft. And didn't he get involved with a movie?
He did. He was a technical consultant on The Aviator, the film about Howard Hughes. How fitting is that?
Very fitting. And he started writing books, too.
5 nonfiction aviation books. And those books, interestingly, led to even more connections.
Like what?
Well, there's a really touching story about an F-4 pilot he'd helped rescue way back early in his tour. Years later, the pilot read one of Merritt's books, realized who he was, and got in touch.
Wow, after all that time.
Yeah. Led to this emotional reunion, a big bottle of champagne shared with the whole CSR group. Just shows the lasting impact of those moments.
He has some reflections on his role in the military overall, doesn't he?
He does. He talks about feeling like a small cog in a big wheel.
Yeah.
You know, focused on doing his job within the larger machine.
Yeah, and his thoughts on the Vietnam War itself.
He offers some pretty candid thoughts. The lack of a clear resolution, the lessons the military perhaps learned or didn't learn about technology versus different kinds of warfare.
Mm.
He also contrasts the value placed on human life.
Right. And his wife had an interesting perspective on the difference between combat bonding and test pilot school.
Yeah, that was really insightful. She pointed out that combat creates bonds through shared danger and adversity, whereas test pilot school was more about individual competition. Different kinds of intense experiences, different kinds of relationships.
So that's a great point. And he's still involved with aviation now.
Very much so. He has a museum, stays active. He mentions getting a B-70 tire for it and planning to get it signed by a former B-70 pilot on his 91st birthday.
Amazing. Just keeps going.
His philosophy seems to be stay active, pursue your passions, share your story. He emphasizes how life takes these unexpected turns and creates connections you never foresee.
So pulling it all together from episode 44, what are the big takeaways for you?
Well, obviously the incredible resilience in the face of extreme danger. The sheer intensity of that CSR mission is unforgettable.
Absolutely. And the camaraderie, those bonds formed under fire, like between Merritt and Kenny Fields, lasting decades.
Yeah, that's huge. And the lasting impact of war, not just on the soldiers, but on their families, too. And I think the unexpected power of human connection that can emerge from even the darkest experiences.
That story about Ed Leonard using his POW time for self-improvement really stands out, too.
It does. It's a remarkable testament to the human spirit's capacity for growth.
This deep dive into George Merritt's story, it gives you such a vivid, personal look at history, doesn't it? Beyond the dates and battles.
It really does. It makes you think about the human cost, the individual experiences within these huge historical events.
And how people find ways to cope, connect, and, well, carry on.
If this has sparked your interest, you could definitely look more into the A1 Skyraider or the history of combat search and rescue, or maybe seek out other veteran accounts from that era. There's so much more to explore.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into George Merritt's incredible story. We'll be back soon with another exploration.